Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
You're listening to a podcast from Washington Post Live, bringing the newsroom to you live.
Hello and welcome to Washington Post Live. I'm Frances Steed Sellers, a senior writer here at the Washington Post. Today, we're going to take another step towards explaining America with chief economist from Moody's Analytics, Mark Zandi. Mark, a very warm welcome to Washington Post Live.
Thank you, Frances. It's good to be with you.
Mark, the U.S. economy has got the rest of the world on tenterhooks right now. The BBC has been updating its explainers about the debt limit showdown. So we have a deal, at least in principle, and I'd love to ask you what you make of it, what our audience should know about it, and whether it does, in fact, leave America stronger, as Speaker McCarthy said in our introductory video.
Well, I look at this obviously from the prism of what does it mean for the economy, the broader economy. And I'll have to say it's about as good as it gets. I mean, given all the various scenarios that could have played out here, I do think this is a reasonably good ending to the story. Hopefully it is the ending and they get this across the finish line in the next few days and pass a piece of legislation that the president can sign. If you kind of add up the totality of all the moving parts here, by my estimate, it'll shave as much as 150,000 jobs from the economy by the end of 2024. That's when the peak of the impact will be felt. Now, that's not great. I mean, the economy is struggling. Recession risks are high. If I were king, this isn't what I would do. But 150K in the grand scheme of things is manageable. Just to provide a little bit of context, the economy currently is providing about 250,000 jobs per month. So 150K is a little over half the job creation in a typical month. It'll add about 0.1% to the unemployment rate. Fortunately, the unemployment rate is very low at 3.4%, shave a bit off of GDP. So, you know, in the grand scheme of things, not great. This isn't what I would do, but you know, it's manageable.
It's manageable, but we're not, as you said, quite off the hook yet, including a meeting this afternoon. Tell us a little bit more about whether you expect this to pass and what the implications would be for the U.S. and for the rest of the world if it did not.
Well, at this point, Frances, I'd be shocked if it didn't. I've got a lot of folks with their reputations on the line. You've got the Speaker of the House, you've got the President of the United States that come together. It's not going to be an easy vote. It's clear that folks on the right wing of the Republican Party are not happy with this. They'd like to see much greater cuts to the budget. And the folks on the left of the Democratic Party, they're not so happy with this. They're not very comfortable with the cuts and some of the other aspects of the plan, like the more restrictive work requirements on SNAP, the food stamp program. But I do think there's enough votes in the middle of the Republican Party and the Democratic Party to come together and get this done. It's not going to be very graceful, I suspect, over the next few days, and it may feel at points that lawmakers may not be able to get across the finish line by that June 5th deadline that you mentioned at the start of the conversation. But, I think the odds are very high if they do. If they don't, if I'm wrong, that'll be just a complete, utter mess. There's lots of scenarios at that point. None of them are any good. They're all just different flavors of darkness, So that's the reason why I think at the end of the day, lawmakers will come to terms and pass this legislation.
So take a step back for me, if you would, and tell us how we got here. I mean, the debt ceiling was a matter of, or increasing the debt was a matter of formality for a long time. What's happening now? And do you think this is now the new normal?
I do think it's the new normal. It goes to our very fractured politics. Our politics have gotten more discordant in recent years, recent decades. Implicit agreement among lawmakers that existed for much of the period for which we've had the debt limit. By the way, Frances, we've had the debt limits in 1917, and for the vast majority of that time, you know, lawmakers came together and increased it or suspended it so that it wouldn't become the issue that it certainly has. But in the last couple of decades, particularly over the last decade, it's become, you know, a cudgel that, you know, one party uses over the other to try to force policy changes. I think that just simply goes to our political environment. It's just very fractured, and we can't seem to come to terms here. The stakes are getting higher, though. You know, I do think if you look at our fiscal outlook, you know, what's going to happen going forward if there are not significant changes to fiscal policy, that's spending policy and tax policy. It's pretty disconcerting. Our debt level is already very high because of all the emergencies that we've had in recent years, and it's going to rise significantly more if there are no changes. So we need to come together, figure out a way to do this in a more amicable, reasonable way. But I'm afraid we're stuck with this debt limit, and that's going to, you know, just create a lot of drama going forward.
Well, you mentioned that date, 1917, and I think Denmark is the only other advanced economy with a debt limit set into the law. Why this system? Just step back a little bit and help me with that, if you could.
Well, the original intent back in 1917 was just to kind of make it easier for Congress to do their job. I mean, the Congress has to approve debt issuance, and that makes sense. The Congress is the keeper of the purse under the Constitution, and they have to say, hey, it's okay, you can issue the debt to finance the government's operations. And they were, you know, prior to 1917, for every issuance of debt, they had to pass a piece of legislation saying, hey, this is okay. And that was getting very cumbersome. And so they decided, okay, we'll just have this debt limit so that it allows us to approve these bond issuances on a regular basis. With regular approval, once we get up to the debt limit, Congress has to come back and rethink all of this. So the original intent was a reasonable one. But it has evolved into this, as I said, cudgel that each party is using on the other to try to force, you know, big changes in a very short period of time. And of course, the problems that we face fiscally are complex, very difficult. They can't be solved in the political cauldron of a debt limit battle that's raging within a matter of days and weeks. We can't solve Social Security or Medicare or Medicaid or decide tax revenue policy in this context. So it's evolved in a way that's very counterproductive. And if I were, again, I keep going back to King, if I were King, fortunately, good or bad, you know, I would do away with this thing altogether. But, you know, unfortunately, we're stuck with it.
Well, one other date I wanted to bring up, 1979, I think that's the only other time when we have sort of got a sense of what it might be like if we defaulted. Tell me a little bit about that. What happened?
Yeah, that was a mistake. That was an accounting word processing error where the Treasury missed a bill payment, just didn't get it done on time. And there's been a lot of academic research of that period trying to figure out, you know, what are the interest costs of that. So, you know, at the end of the day, investors buy U.S. Treasury debt at such a low interest rate, lower than anywhere else in the world, because it's money good. They know that they're going to get paid back on time, and there's no question about it. It's risk-free, and therefore you get a lower interest rate. In this case, Treasury messed up, had this accounting word processing error. Investors didn't get their money on time. It was delayed, and it did result in higher interest rates for an extended period of time because investors didn't know, well, are they going to make the same mistake next time? And if so, I need compensation for that, which means a higher interest rate. So if you add it all up, it was not inconsequential. I can't quite remember the dollar amounts, but it was meaningful. And of course, that was back then. Now, when you have $31 trillion in debt, even a very teeny increase in interest rates adds up to a lot of money, you know, very quickly. And, you know, we certainly don't want to go down that path.
Yeah, and this debt ceiling seems like a sort of blunt instrument, but would Congress act in any way over American debt if it didn't have this deadline to meet?
Yeah, I think they would, but that they we figure this out. It, actually, it's, you know, we get stuff done. You know, I think it's up to the voters. Like, for example, when President Trump was president and the Republicans controlled the House and the Senate, we got the Trump tax cuts. You know, you might not like them, but they got them done. And the voters voted and said, hey, you know, this is what President Trump ran on, and you know, therefore, this is what we want. President Biden, when he won and had both control of both the Senate and House, he got a lot done. Got the American Rescue Plan, you got the CHIPS Act, the Inflation Reduction Act, which goes to climate change primarily, the bipartisan infrastructure law to help improve our infrastructure, and those are big pieces of legislation that we got a lot done. Voters voted. So I think when push comes to shove, voters just make a decision and we can accomplish many things. Now, having said all of that, I think there are some tweaks we can make to the debt limit process to make it more helpful, more productive. I think it's a bridge too far politically to think that lawmakers are going to vote to get rid of it. So maybe we can make an adjustment here or two to make it more useful. But I would say at the end of the day, you know, we will do what's necessary. You know, there's an old Winston Churchill quote. I'm going to butcher this. You probably know it. Something to the effect that, you know, Americans try everything and then ultimately do the right thing. This feels right to me. I feel like that's what would happen here. We'd ultimately do the right thing.
Well, let me ask you about entitlement programs, which are often what come up on Social Security and Medicare in particular that people think are not sustainable. What are your concerns here, and what do you think the future of those programs are?
Yeah, that's Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. Social Security, Medicare, that's help out folks that are older. Medicaid to help out folks that are low income and in poverty. And you have to take each one of these aside and take them by themselves. Social Security is actually relatively straightforward in my mind. And here I would just increase the earnings that are subject to the payroll tax. You know, right now there's a cap on the earnings of that are taxed up to, I think it's about 140, 145K. Just say, hey, if you make over, you pay that, and then if you make over 400K, you pay tax on that as well. If we do that, simply that change, and that seems to make, that makes a lot of sense to me, because, you know, the percent of earnings that are not taxed has increased over time since the Social Security was put on the planet back in the Great Depression because of income and wealth inequality and the skewing of the income and wealth distribution. If we simply did make that change, we put Social Security on, I think, very sound ground. I don't know if we'd solve it forever, but we get pretty close. Medicare and Medicaid are in my mind, more difficult because that goes to the cost of medical care and also the aging of the population for Medicare. If we want to simply provide the same benefits, healthcare benefits to older Americans, we are going to have to generate more tax revenue. So they're a little bit more complex. I think we need to make some changes with regard to prescription drugs, get the cost of that down, and also some tax revenue there. But I think that's also doable. So these are big problems, and you know, obviously, not only political problems, but economic problems. But I think they are solvable at the end of the day.
When you look at those programs and other ones, how does America's debt, where it spends its money, compare with its peer nations?
Well, we, compared to other developed economies, particularly, let's say, in Europe, we tend to have a somewhat smaller government. So, you know, tax revenue as a share of our economy, of GDP, our spending as a share of GDP is lower. Most other developed economies have, you know, universal health care, you know, provided by the government. The UK is a great example of that, and they pay for it. So we tend to have a smaller government, certainly at the federal level. We do more at the state level than other countries. They tend to be a little bit more centralized. But broadly speaking, you know, government tends to be smaller here. And the amount of tax revenue that's generated tends to be less. We run big deficits, but our debt load has been rising. But that's not unique to the United States. Every country on the planet has struggled with this. And this goes to the shocks that we've been suffering in recent years. The most notable, obviously, the most recently would be the pandemic. That was very, very costly. Governments had to ante up a lot of money to, you know, kind of navigate through all that. And of course, the financial crisis back a little over a decade ago was very costly. So, you know, we've had our fair share of unforeseen shocks that have been very, very costly. But that's universal across the globe. That's not just a U.S. problem. That's a global problem.
Yeah, I would like to ask you a little bit more about the spending on the pandemic. America did not do incredibly well on the health outcomes from the pandemic. How is that money being spent? And do you see it as being spent in the right places during the pandemic, for the pandemic?
Well, we spent a lot. You're right. I mean, $5 trillion when you add it all up. That began with the CARES Act that was passed in March of 2020, right after the pandemic hit under President Trump. And then we had a couple of other packages. And then, of course, it ended with the American Rescue Plan. That was the last COVID relief plan that was passed in March of 2021. So over that roughly 1 year period, $5 trillion. That's a lot of spending. That's close to 25% of GDP at the time. It succeeded in some very important respects, right, Francis? I mean, for example, the unemployment rate today is 3.4%. That's about as low as it's ever been. And that goes to just that response. It was, incredibly aggressive in trying to support the economy, and it got us back fast. It has contributed, but here we are. There's been a lot of debate about whether all that spending has contributed to the high inflation that we're suffering right now and the interest rate hikes the Federal Reserve is engineering to try to quell that high inflation. In my view, that was certainly the case back in 2021, going into 2022. Demand got juiced up by all that support, and the labor market got disrupted by all of that support, and that conspired to push up inflation. I don't think that's contributing significantly to the inflationary problems we have right now. That's a host of other reasons we can talk about. But but having said that, it's a reasonable debate, and we can have a lot of discussion around that. I do think at this point, there are still some unspent COVID relief money that's sitting out there, and that's being pulled back in to help pay for this debt limit agreement. And I think that makes, there's a lot of things that want to be the states and others want to do with that money. But I see that if you need to save money, that's a reasonable place to do it, because, we did spend a lot on getting the economy back up and running. And you can question how well we spent the money. I mean, it did highlight a number of real problems in the way we deliver help to the economy. Unemployment insurance is a great example. That was a big part of the cost. If you become unemployed, you get a check. And that unemployment insurance system is a program that has the federal government involved and state governments involved. And that really did not work very well at all in lots of different respects. So, hopefully lawmakers of the future take the lessons that we learned during the pandemic, identify those areas where we can make some changes and actually make those reforms, because, that we didn't need to spend $5 trillion to get to the place where we are today.
Another quick question about the budget, not so much about the size of the U.S. budget, but comparatively with other countries, the kinds of things that the U.S. puts its money into. Are there any standouts there you'd like to talk about?
Well, obviously defense, right? We spend a boatload on defense. I mean, we're, the budget, that's one place that did not get cut in this debt limit deal. President Biden said, I want to raise defense spending by, I think it's 3 or 4% per annum. And Republicans said, fine, so we're going to spend that money. I think the budget is about $900 billion. That's about 3.5%-ish of GDP. It's down from where it was, if you go back 20, 30, 40 years ago, but it's still very, very high compared to the rest of the world. So, if you had to identify the one thing that we spend a lot of money on that other countries don't spend nearly as much on, is that. Now, I do think there's a lot of benefits to that. We are the protector of much of the global economy and trade and transportation because of our military. And that's a benefit to many other countries, but obviously generates enormous benefit to us as well. So, I think it's important that we do this, but it is a standout, expense that other countries don't have, at least not nearly to the same degree that we do.
And then the other side of the ledger, the tax system, the revenue system. How does that compare to the ways other countries bring in money?
Yeah, I don't think that's too dissimilar. It's similar. I mean, we rely on personal income tax. I mentioned the payroll tax to pay for Social Security and the other entitlement programs. We have a corporate income tax that's relatively small, and over time, that's become a smaller source of revenue because of the tax cuts that have been implemented, and because of the ability of large corporations to move their earnings overseas where it's not taxed here in the U.S. at the same rate. But broadly speaking, I'd say our tax system is not dissimilar. other countries are a bit more willing to try, you know, like a so-called VAT tax, a sales tax. Some countries are imposing carbon-related taxes to generate revenue, but more importantly, to try to raise the cost of carbon emission and address climate change. So other developed economies are more willing to go down those paths than we are. But broadly speaking, I think the tax codes are not too dissimilar.
Let me ask you about another hot button issue, immigration and the impact of immigrants on the American economy. Is the U.S. doing enough to bring in immigrants and keep that economy ticking over and growing?
It's a mess. I mean, obviously, we really messed this up badly. And by the way, Francis, in my view, immigration is one of the things that makes the American economy so exceptional. It makes us tick. You know, it's the difference between our dynamic economy and, you know, let's say the Japanese economy, where immigration is not really, part of their experience. You know, obviously, there's a lot of adjustment to all the immigration that occurs. But at the end of the day, I think it's a, you know, very significant positive. But we've really worked hard to, you know, make this a real problem. You know, obviously, given what's going on at the southern border, you know, it's very unfortunate and disconcerting because, you know, we came pretty close to immigration reform, you know, back in a little over a decade ago. You know, in the Senate, it got very far, had a lot of Republican support as well. And we just missed by a little bit. And that's a shame because that would have gone a long way to improving, you know, our immigration system, making it more rational, trying to help bring in the best and the brightest and keep them here in the United States of America. I mean, it's the weirdest thing. You know, we've got these great universities, the best all want to come here and get educated. And then we don't make it easy for them to stay. You know, it's like crazy. I keep going back. If I were a king, if you graduated from an American accredited American university college, I'd stamp a visa right on your head, say, we want you to stay. But we don't do that. We make life, you know, very difficult for those very educated entrepreneurial individuals. So I think if there's one thing that could really be a game changer for our economy quickly, and also help our budget situation, because obviously the best way to address our budget situation is to have a stronger economy to generate more tax revenue, simply because you have more income and more profits that are taxed, not at a higher tax rate, but, you know, at the same tax rate, would be immigration reform, because that would both lift the growth in our labor force and economy, but also because immigrants tend to be entrepreneurial, start companies at a higher rate than native born. We'd have a more innovative economy, a more productive economy, and ultimately a sounder economy.
Mark, I have a little bit of a why in that. We've had several people on this show who've talked about innovation and coming to this country, immigrants who've come to this country and done incredibly well here. Is that something to do with immigrants or America? What is it that makes people blossom here and make so much money?
Both, I'm sure. I mean, I do think immigrants, by definition, are risk takers, right? I mean, when you think about it, moving your family to another place and saying, hey, you know, we're going to leave behind, you know, all that we know and go to a place that we don't, that's risk taking, you know, by definition. And that's what you need to be an entrepreneur, you know, an innovator, is to take risk. And I think just by definition, you know, they're risk takers and they're entrepreneurial and they're very hardworking. But our American system makes it easier for them to survive and flourish here. You know, we do have a culture of entrepreneurship, small businesses, or a lot of small businesses drive, you know, a lot of economic activity here. And even going back to our financial system, and this is manifested in many different ways, but you can see it in our banking system. Most countries are dominated by just a handful of banks. They have very few small, mid-sized banks. Here in the United States of America, we've got big guys like, you know, think J.P. Morgan or Bank of America, but we got a lot of small, mid-sized banks. We got 4,700 banks in all, and those small banks, they cater to small business. So we've got the whole system that we've set up here is designed to help innovate and to become entrepreneurial and, you know, invent the next big thing that's going to drive economic growth and create a lot of wealth. So I think it's both, Francis. You know, the immigrants are inherently risk takers, and, you know, we facilitate that in the system that we've established here in the United States.
So, Mark, I think any observer of this country sees the huge gap between the wealthy and the enormous poverty in this country. Is that inevitable? Is that how do you explain that? Is that a good thing or a bad thing from the economic point of view and also from the social point of view?
Well, I'm not comfortable with it. I mean, especially given how quickly the income and wealth distribution has become skewed. Mm-hmm. I mean, it began really, you know, the flattest our income distribution has ever been was back in the 70s and early 80s. And since then, it's become increasingly more skewed for, you know, I think lots of different reasons. And I don't view that as a positive development. Certainly, it's not a good thing for all the folks that are being left behind, and that's plenty of folks. And it makes our economy less stable because, you know, these households are taking on a lot of their own debt and borrowing very aggressively. One of the reasons why I think the financial crisis occurred was a lot of lower income households got access and took down a lot of credit, mortgage loans and credit card loans and auto loans. And that was inherently unmanageable financially for them, and it, you know, blew up and took out our system and took out the economy. So there is a very, you can connect the dots from the skewing of the income and wealth distribution back to the kind of the volatility of our business cycle, and that's to no one's benefit. And I do think there is evidence that particularly as the income and wealth distribution gets more skewed, it weighs on economic growth. It disenfranchises parts of the population and it makes it less likely that they can achieve their potential. And that undermines the underlying productivity growth and labor force growth and participation and all the things that, you know, drive an economy. So yeah, I think this is a very significant deal. And I do think it's something that lawmakers should consider whenever making economic policy. They should make economic policy, but they also need to think of that policy through the prism of what it means for the broader income and wealth distribution. Here's the other thing, Francis. I do think there is some argument to be made that our fractured politics, you know, which were where we talked, where we started the conversation, our discordant politics, goes back to our skewed income and wealth distribution.
So do you see a way of rectifying that in a neat way that is acceptable to the public?
Well, the obvious ways, sounds hackneyed, but it's just pretty clear. You know, we need to think about how to improve the educational system for disadvantaged groups. I live in Philadelphia. I grew up in Philadelphia, in the Philadelphia area. And, Pennsylvania has a particularly vexed system for funding its schools. It's based on a lot of it comes from property taxes, from local property taxes. In the wealthy schools, like the one I went to when I went to high school, it was a public school, got a lot of money, but it was, you know, very wealthy. And then you go, and I'm in the suburbs of Philly, you go into the city of Philly and you go take a look at those schools, it's just a complete mess because they don't get any funding because they're relying on the tax base for that part for the city, and the city's got all kinds of problems. So, you know, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense in the context of trying to address the income and wealth inequality that we experience. It's about, in part, educating the population. So we have to really rethink, you know, how this is working and funding the school system and education and childcare, early childcare, those kinds of things that, you know, raises the educational attainment of the population. This is a very complex problem, lots of moving parts. It's not just one solution, but if I had to pick one thing that I would focus on and put it at the top of the list of things I think we need to focus on, it would be that. We need to improve the educational attainment of the population.
Mark, a last question. I wish I had time for more, but the American dream, it's all about upward mobility. Do you think today it's alive and well?
Well, I think it's alive. I do think mobility is still happening. You know, I do think that, you know, if you do take a chance and start a company, start a business, you have a good chance. You have a chance of succeeding. That's a key part of the American dream that's alive. I don't know that it's well. We've got a lot of challenges. We talked about the income and wealth inequality that exists that is making it difficult for all Americans to achieve that dream. And our politics are very vexed and complicated, and it makes it difficult for us to come together and find solutions, at least in a timely way, to address the issues so that, you know, the American dream does thrive going forward. So we have our challenges, and I do think it's hard to argue that it's well, but it's certainly alive. But I want to end on an optimistic note. I do think, you know, at the end of the day, Americans solve problems. That's what we do. That's what makes us exceptional. And I think we haven't lost that, and that'll continue to be the case. And we continue to we'll continue to lead the rest of the global economy.
Mark Zandi, thank you so much for helping us to solve several problems this morning.
Thanks for the opportunity. Always nice to be king, at least on Washington Post Live. So thank you.
King for the morning. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for listening. For more information on our upcoming programs, go to WashingtonPostLive.com.